Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Eamon, welcome.
How are you doing?
I'm good. You're not a massive drinker either,
no,
are you?
The odd glass of wine, that's about the size of it.
Yeah.
No, definitely not pinting.
Yeah. Do you come across many people in the practice who did Dry January?
Yeah, and of course, as people know, I'm retired now at this stage, so I'm not in the practice as often.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you would see people from time to time who would do Dry January, or indeed that to be the beginning of Lent or something. You know, they find some reason to stop drinking. Not a lot, I think, is the answer. But I can certainly identify with what you were saying about the fact that there's a perception that there's a change in the individual just because they're no longer drinking. And again, you've said it quite rightly, it goes to the core of our culture. Now, to be fair, it's not just an Irish thing. I think we can't just say it's the Irish only do this, because a lot of other cultures where drink plays a significant part. But certainly not the Irish culture. There is a perception, and I agree with that here. I mean, the thing is, if your relationship is defined by drink, that's not a relationship.
Yeah, that's true. No, I would argue with you. I think it is very much an Irish thing, because so many people drink in this country.
Oh, I know, yeah. I know. What I'm saying is that I'm aware of other cultures, though, that where people drink as heavily. Now, yeah. I think the difference is perhaps that there might be more solitary drinking, and that it might be as much of the mix of culture and crack
and
alcohol that goes on in Ireland. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, weddings, wakes, funerals, you name it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Eamon, we'll move on from that. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's been a fortnight since we were both here, because I was off last week as well. Just reminding people, general queries this week, if you have a query for Eamon, you can phone it through to Brenda on the phones today, 066-712-3666. We'll start with one or two from last week, Eamon. A female caller has a family member... Oh, sorry. The caller has a family member who is a 50-year-old female, constantly getting chest infections. She used to be a smoker, but she's given up. Is her immune system low? She's constantly on antibiotics and they're not working as well as they used to.
Yeah, I think, okay, our immune systems are an extraordinarily complex thing, and there are a few individuals in whom you will meet true immune deficiency states, and individuals who develop the true immune deficiency states are in serious trouble, because having an effective functioning immune system is so core to our well-being and health. I don't think it's necessarily a weakness, because I've heard this a couple of times, there must be something wrong with my immune system. I think there are other things that are going on here. Our listener's problem, or the relative's problem, is the recurring cough. And the fact that they were a smoker, I think, is significant. And I suspect that there's an element of chronic bronchitis, but there may also be an element of asthma there. I think it speaks to a story that not everybody who coughs necessarily has an infection. I was in the practice for a day yesterday. I did meet somebody who has had a cough for the last 2 months, and almost certainly their cough is as a result of a medication they're taking. All right. But you can also see, and we're seeing a lot of underdiagnosed asthma in the community as well, and people with underdiagnosed or undiagnosed asthma may well have recurring bouts of cough. So I think there is a bit more to be picked apart here in terms of what's the nature of the cough, when does the person get it, do they always bring up phlegm with it, what is their lung function like, and their ways and means of checking in that. So there are a couple of things. At the end of the day, what you're looking for is to protect and preserve the person's lung function, not to let it deteriorate any further, and to do the best you can to try to reduce or relieve their symptoms. And there are a variety of medications that will do both of those things, but you need to work out what it is the problem in the first instance.
Yeah, so back to the doctor maybe.
Yeah, have a chat, yeah.
Now, a listener says, my partner is on one tablet daily for the last 5 years to treat chronic heartburn. Mm. Should he be worried about esophageal cancer? He's 57.
Yeah.
He doesn't say whether he smokes or not.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. And indeed, do they take alcohol? Because that's a bearing in it as well, too. There are lots of people who, for a variety of reasons, are taking long-term, and I hope low-dose, what we call proton pump inhibitors. So there's various drugs, and I won't go into the brand names, but people know them well. And they are very effective at reducing the amount of acid your stomach produces. Indeed, it's important that if somebody is taking these medications over a long period of time, that they would take the lower rather than the higher dose, because they're so effective. They can block the absorption of certain vitamins, for which we need a certain amount of acid to be able to absorb. Vitamin B12, for example, is a good example. I think the thing I would be looking at here is that I would have a low threshold or a high index of suspicion that if the man in this case has any sort of problems of symptoms, I mean, with the tablets he's taking, he should have no symptoms whatsoever. In other words, he should have no heartburns, he shouldn't have any difficulty swallowing or anything like that. But if he does have any sign of recurring heartburn, or indeed specifically if he has any issues with swallowing whatsoever, then I think he'd need to speak to his own doctor, who will organise an urgent gastroscopy for him, because that's the definitive investigation, the definitive procedure to work out what's going on.
This next question is from a lady in her 20s. She says, if you have a clear brain MRI for tingling and numbness, do you ever need to repeat the MRI? And she says that her symptoms have improved.
Okay, that's a bit of a loaded question, because you see, the thing is that why was the MRI done in the first instance? Now, it may very well have been done to be able to give you the appropriate assurance that there wasn't anything bad or dangerous going on. If your symptoms are subsiding, then in the ordinary course of events, no, there wouldn't be any need to repeat the MRI. What you would be looking out for, though, is that if the person did have recurrence of their symptoms or they developed something new, then it might be appropriate to repeat the investigation in that case. But kind of a repeat MRI, I can't think of. There are a few situations where people have MRIs done and things are incidentally found, cysts and things like that, and you might have a follow-up MRI 6 months later just to make sure it's not changing. But in the ordinary course of events, no, there wouldn't be need to repeat the MRI.
A caller in her late 60s from Listowel, she says, why is my mouth dry most of the time, especially in the morning? I always have a bad taste in my mouth in the morning and a burning sensation on my tongue and the roof of my mouth that feels sore from time to time.
Yeah, a couple of things that would strike me there. First and foremost, is our listener taking any medication of any sort? Because that would be the very first thing I'd look for, because there are a number of medications that will give you a dry mouth. There's a group of drugs called the anticholinergic drugs. It's a whole big number of them there, and they're notorious for causing dry mouths. After that, you may well have a problem with one of these autoimmune disorders, one of these conditions where your immune system goes a bit wonky and attacks your body, and that in turn can give you a burning or sore mouth. The third thing is it may well be a bit of reflux. It could be that the person is refluxing acid during the night, and that's burning their mouth, and that's giving them their symptoms. One way or the other, I think it's important that they would talk to their own GP to have this thing investigated further.
Okay. Now, this next question, Eamon, and this is a classic case of not knowing whether it's male or female,
right?
And it could be very different answers
depending,
but it is someone in their early 50s, and the person says, and please, if that person is listening, text us and let us know whether you're male or female. But the person says, I have what I think is are extremely sore lumps under the skin in my pubic area. Very itchy, mainly at night or when touched. It's going on for 6 months. I've used a lot of different creams that were prescribed, but nothing is working, and it's extremely embarrassing.
I think it's time to be seen by an appropriate or relevant specialist in this situation. So depending on the gender, it may be that you need to see a gynecologist or a urologist. Other possibilities, and I don't know whether this has been investigated previously, is that if you have itchy sore lumps in the pubic areas, that you may unfortunately may have a sexually transmitted infection as well. And another option would be, in ultra confidence, go and attend the STI clinic, because they're in Cork and Limerick, and they will carry out the appropriate investigations, and if necessary, then give you the correct treatment. So there are a couple of options there.
So can this person just phone up the STI clinic?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, very much. And I mean, I will from time to time refer people to the STI clinic in the knowledge I will never ever hear anything back about it, because the clinics are ultra confidential, and if you do turn up, nobody's ever going to know that you were there.
And you don't need a doctor's referral?
No, you just turn up.
So one in Cork and one in Limerick.
Exactly.
None in Kerry, no?
They were running a satellite clinic from Cork. Now, I'm not sure whether they are still running it or not. I don't know, is the honest answer. If you ring the Cork number, Google the STI clinic in Cork. It's in the Sutton Infirmary Victoria Hospital. If you Google them, their number, I should know the number off the top of my head, but I don't. You ring them and they can tell you straight away whether there's a clinic in Kerry. If not, you go to Cork and you get seen there, or go to Limerick.
And that same answer applies whether it's a man or a woman.
Exactly, so that's the point.
Yeah, fair enough. Eamon, we better take a break at this stage, and just to remind people, I know I say it every week, but if you are texting or WhatsApping the question to us, do let us know whether you're a male or female. We also need to know roughly how old you are, because remember, the more detail Eamon has, the more comprehensively he can answer the query for you. And again, it's 083 300 3300 if you are texting or WhatsApping. Just coming up to 16 minutes past 2, more Medical Matters after these.
Medical Matters on Talk About. brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Now, Eamon, this next question is about coffee, of all things.
Right.
There's an unusual one for you. From a male caller, he says, I'm confused about coffee. In health articles, you read that 3 cups is fine, or some say 4 could be the max. I'd love Eamon's point of view on this. What does he think is the max? And is it true that coffee can be bad for your cholesterol levels?
Yeah. The last bit, I have no idea. I can't see a mechanism whereby coffee could impact on your cholesterol unless you're taking, I don't know, megadose or something. The problem is that it's the old cliche of, you know, how long is a piece of string? And then it's all things in moderation. Some people will tolerate 5 and 6 cups of coffee a day without any bother whatsoever. Other people will get the jitters if they take a single cup of decaffeinated coffee. There's a huge individual variability. I'm aware that there are suggestions that certain volumes of coffee are good or bad for you, but these tend to be what they call retrospective studies, and they're observational studies, and what they're doing is they're looking at groups of people and say, right, this group of people took this many cups of coffee a day and this thing happened to them. Now, does that mean that because they took that many cups of coffee a day, that thing was going to happen to them, is what I'm saying. So these studies are fraught with all sorts of difficulties. It goes back to what I said earlier on, it's the all things in moderation. You know, as much as you are comfortable with, but don't do the dog in it completely. There is no specific answer to that.
Okay, so, you know, as vices go, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not the worst. It's not the worst.
Now, this listener says she is female and 75, and she's wondering, is it okay to keep taking duloxetine, that's what it is, for nerve pain?
Yeah, duloxetine has been around for a while. It's used for a variety of things. It's used for overactive bladders. It's used for nerve pain. It's used in some occasions for anxiety and depression because of the mechanism of action. The whole subject of what we call chronic pain is a really difficult and fraught one, and maybe someday we could get somebody on with me to have a chat about the subject, one of the pain specialists. There has been a lot of work done in terms of researching this thing. The difficulty is that our brain gets flooded with signals every day, and most of these signals our brain will filter out. I'm talking about literally when you pull on your clothes in the morning, for the few seconds you'll be conscious you're wearing the clothes, and then for the rest of the day you're not conscious of it at all because your brain will filter those signals out. It's the same with painful stimuli. Some people are very sensitive to pain signals, others are not. People can suffer damage, and the difficulty with the chronic pain is that oftentimes after the original damage has long since gone, the person has been left with a pain. And we use the term chronic pain, chronic being long-term pain, typically at least three and possibly 6 months. But people can often have this going on for years. And sometimes the only way they can manage the pain is by taking medication like this, like the duloxetine. Now, the difficulty is that there are no good painkillers. And what I mean to say by that is there are painkillers which will reduce the pain, but they all have side effects, all right? Now, if the duloxetine is keeping your pain under control and is not causing you any excessive difficulties, then I would suggest to continue with it if you've been taking it for some period of time. There are other groups of medications. There's a group of drugs called the gabapentoids that I know the Irish Medical Council are taking a look at because they're concerned about its abuse. And of course, there's the whole range of the so-called opiate drugs like morphine and other similar drugs that again are used widely for pain, but also have potential for side effects. So it's a fraught area. Long story short, if you're getting relief from this, if you don't seem to be having any difficulties with it, carry on. Generally, the duloxetine is reasonably well tolerated. I was talking earlier on about the so-called anticholinergic drugs. I think duloxetine might be one of those, but for the most part, people tolerate it reasonably well.
Now, a Tralee caller felt completely and utterly exhausted yesterday and was frozen with the cold. Did a COVID test but was negative.
Yeah.
Wondering, could it be something else?
Yeah. Okay, if he was grand the day before and feeling lousy yesterday, and if hopefully he's feeling a bit better today, likely is that some viral infection was passing through his system. And basically what was happening was that his body was responding to the infection. How? One, by the tiredness part of his body signaling, well, you've got to take it easy, slow down, give yourself a chance. And the second bit is that if you remember, probably about 2 years ago now, this is Dr. Fergus Lee, he came on at one stage, we were talking about temperatures in children. And the same applies in adults. Temperature is an indication that your immune system is doing what it's supposed to do. By increasing our temperature, what we do is we increase the rate at which our immune system will deal with whatever infection is there, get it out of the system quicker. But while our temperature is going up, we're going to feel frozen, because that's our body trying to drive up the temperature. And then, of course, conversely, once the fever breaks, once we start to get better, we then feel roasting hot and we feel the opposite direction. So my own sense is that there was something passing through the system yesterday. I hope for our listeners' sake it's gone today or it'll be gone the next day or two anyway.
And if it's not, then...
Oh yeah, have a chat.
Have a chat with the doctor. On a not dissimilar vein, a caller is asking, is there a virus going around at the moment that's affecting people's eyes? Has Eamon heard anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, you will see throughout the year, but particularly at this time of the year, you'll get viral conjunctivitis, you'll get an inflammation of the eyes. It can give itchy, sore, watery, red eyes. Simple lubricants can often be of benefit, but if the eyes are getting sticky, and particularly if the eyelids start to get this, you know, if I find them stuck together in the morning, you may have a bacterial infection, in which case you might benefit from getting an antibiotic eye drop.
Okay. A 30-year-old male was in touch. He has tingling and numbness in his legs, especially at night. The doctor prescribed magnesium tablets, but there's still no improvement.
Yeah. You see, again, tingling indicates that there is something interfere with the signalling from the legs to the brain. So the way it works is that you touch something off the leg, it'll generate a signal. That signal will travel to the brain and the brain will register that pressure, whatever it is. Where you're getting tingling, it indicates that there is extra signal that's being generated by the nerve for some reason. Now, this can be due to pressure directly on the nerve, or it could be some issue with the nerve itself. My own sense in this case is that because the problem is persisting, you need to go back to your own GP and organise the further or whatever appropriate investigations to get this thing checked out for yourself.
All right. Here's an interesting one. Male listener in his late 40s wants to know if Eamon can discuss the issue of falling testosterone levels in men and the effect it has. He says, we hear a lot about women's hormone levels and rightly so, but am I right in saying that men's hormone levels drop and that can also affect their weight, sleep, fatigue, mood and sex drive from mid-40s onwards? Would testosterone supplements be something he would recommend?
Not routinely. I think that's important to say from the outset. I'm not saying there aren't men who have hypogonadism and people who do genuinely have low testosterone levels, but it is not common. It is really genuinely not a common problem. And there are concerns that the use, or indeed the abuse of testosterone, may increase the rate of prostatic and indeed testicular cancer. So it's something that you need to be, that needs to be. Very occasionally, it is actually relatively rare that you will see men with true testosterone deficiency. I need to be careful because there are individuals who undoubtedly will be suffering from this, but it is relatively rare. And I suspect that we're probably seeing a lot fewer men who have this kind of issue compared to women who have estrogen deficiency. There's very good biological reasons why a woman will go through estrogen deficiency, where she'll go through menopause at the end of the reproductive life. When the ovaries have finished producing eggs, that's it. There's a very specific biological event. There is no analogous event in men. There's no analogous event in men. The testosterone continue to produce, the testes continue to produce testosterone throughout a man's life. The levels can fall, and they probably do fall as we get older, but are they falling to clinically significant levels? And I would suggest that, yes, there are a few men who have true testosterone deficiency, but there's a lot of other things that can cause the man to have the symptoms that he's experiencing.
So the weight, the sleep, lack of sex drive, all of that.
There are a lot of other reasons for that besides just testosterone deficiency.
Okay. 65-year-old male on high blood pressure tablets, but he says he always feels lifeless and tired. Should he have an angiogram? He had one done years ago.
Yeah, I'd be looking at the medication itself first. I mean, bear in mind that medications are a double-edged sword and they're very good on the one hand for relieving whatever condition you're being treated for, but there's very, very few medications that don't have potential side effects. If you're feeling lethargic and tired, the first thing I'd be looking at is this a side effect of your medication? And that's a conversation you should probably be having with your GP in the first instance. Yes, if you have any other symptoms, you might benefit from a cardiology review. I wouldn't be going directly or straight away for an angiogram. Angiograms are invasive procedures, albeit that they're done very frequently. But at the same time, that needs to be checked out. I'd suggest have a chat about your medication in the first instance.
Here's one about a 15-year-old boy, Eamon. On occasion, he gets a squint in his eye, often after indoor sport. He had PE today at school and his eye is twitching and he says it's going blurry as well.
Yeah.
He also has a twitch under the eyelid on a daily basis. Could it be lack of magnesium?
No, well, this is one of those situations. Please don't self-diagnose and I'll be taking supplements. You need to be seen by somebody. You need to see one of our ophthalmic physician colleagues. There are a number of them around the county. Your own GP will point you in the right direction. Somebody needs to check your eyes out properly for you and get you the correct treatment.
Okay, for the boy. It's obviously the parent getting in touch. We're nearly finished, Eamon. I'm sorry now, but we've had so many queries today. We'll squeeze in one or two more quickly. A female in her early 80s, under the left scapula, has an itchy spot. It's sometimes tender. There's no mark, but it's very itchy at night. She's on statins and she thinks it started around the time she started the statins.
Okay, it's unlikely the statin itself is the cause of this particular symptoms because statins, because they affect the whole body, would tend to give symptoms all over the body. If you have persistent symptoms there, even if you don't have a rash, you might need to be seen by a dermatologist. Now, the reality is dermatology appointments are like gold dust at the moment, publicly and privately. They really are very difficult to get appointments with a dermatologist. But I'd suggest that you talk to a dermatologist to get them to have a look at that thing for you. Something as localised as that would indicate to me there's something going on there under the scapula, under the wing bone.
One final one, Eamon. I know we're over time. No. Bally Desmond listener, he says he had prostate cancer 3 years ago. After the treatment, the flow of urine was very slow.
Yeah.
He went back to hospital and was put on a speedy cath flex. Which he has to use twice a week. The flow has much improved since, but he wants to know, will he be using this for life now?
Yeah. Again, there's a problem there because every time you introduce a catheter or a tube into the bladder, in either men or women, but particularly in men, you can cause scarring of the inside of the water passage, the urethra, which in itself will cause a narrowing of the passage, can slow down the flow of urine. I would see catheters as a very occasionally necessary evil. I will try to avoid using them if possible. I prefer to try and use the underlying thing. The difficulty is that once you start using catheter on a regular basis, it is very difficult. I'm not saying impossible, but it's very difficult to stop using it because what tends to happen is that the passageway closes down and you get to the point where you may go into what's called urinary retention, where you can't pass any urine at all, which is a really, really, really unpleasant thing to have happen to you. And then you're going to have to put in the catheter anyway.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, Eamon, we're going to have to leave it there. Just a text in from someone who says, I must say Dr. Eamon is absolutely fantastic, so knowledgeable and so good at communicating his advice.
Thank you so much.
So we'll end on a lovely positive note there. Hear, hear. Eamon, thank you. Good to
Indeed,
have you back.
We'll talk again.
And we'll chat to you next week.
Please,
all going well. We take a break, folks.